Joseph Block, registration number 16783, on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Baumgarten. I'd first like to indicate to your honors that there is no disagreement that the trial court retains jurisdiction over child support, and child support is always modifiable pursuant to 1410.115 and 1410.122. Similarly, there is no disagreement that Colorado law prohibits parties from contracting away their child support obligations. Such agreements are held time and time again to be void against public policy. So there's no disagreement on behalf of the appellant that the court has the jurisdiction to always modify child support. But this issue is not about child support. It has to do with the maintenance obligation. Just in a way of background, the permanent orders were in 2008 and included orders for $1,244 for child support and $4,500 for maintenance. An appeal was subsequently filed on the property issues. Mediation was ordered by this court, and the parties entered into mediation and entered into an agreement regarding all issues before the court, appellate court, and also on other issues. The memorandum of understanding, which is attached as Exhibit 1 in our opening brief, was signed as an order of the court on September 21st, 2008. The operative section for purposes of this appeal is that appellant paid $215,000 as a lump sum payment for further monthly child support payments to the appellee. And in paragraph 3, based on the calculation, child support was increased from $1,244 a month to $1,622 a month. Specifically, paragraph 3 stated, and which is the crux of the appeal, for purposes of child support only, once the lump sum payment is provided by the respondent, child support shall be modified. The worksheet will reflect a $2,157 per month payment by respondent to petitioner to be included in petitioner's income and deducted from respondent's income for a period of 54 months. And based on this calculation, the new child support became $1,622 a month.
Excuse me, counsel, could I ask just a quick question? Is the $2,157, does the record indicate whether that was a negotiated number or was that based on a straight calculation?
It was based on a straight calculation of child support.
Okay.
Based on the incomes of the parties. In paragraph 2, the memorandum of understanding that became an order of the court also expressly indicated that maintenance is contractual, non-modifiable, and that the trial court was divested of any other jurisdiction regarding modifying this agreement of the parties. So the parties entered into the agreement. $215,000 was paid by the appellant to the appellee pursuant to the order. A few months after this, on December 30th, 2008, appellee filed a motion to modify child support. On January 9, 2010, the court entered orders modifying the child support. And the court indicated that the incomes have changed, and which resulted in more than a 10% change in child support, and ordered the child support to be currently held at $2,180 a month and made it retroactive pending hearing the motion. So the child support was ordered at $2,180. After reviewing the child support calculation of the court, it became apparent that the court inadvertently failed to take judicial notice of the previous order, which allows for the spousal maintenance deduction and credit on the party's child support worksheets. So this was omitted from the court when he modified child support. So appellant filed a motion for reconsideration indicating to the court that he failed to provide for those credits. And then the order on February 10, 2010, the court stated that agreed with the appellee's reasoning, and then the specific dicta he indicated in his order was, in the event the order is unclear regarding the impact upon a prior order, the court's orders and rules that any prior term of any prior any order inconsistent with January 9, 2010 order is vacated. All orders shall be read as consistent with the January 9th, 2010 order.
Mr. Block, is your argument that the trial court didn't take into account paragraph 3 of the memorandum of understanding, or that the trial court was precluded from modifying child support, or both?
No, the court was not precluded from modifying child support, as I said from the beginning. The court always has continuing jurisdiction to modify child support. What the court did in its calculation was fail to take judicial notice of the previous order and allow for those credits. Appellant, you know, paid consideration for that agreement, and this had to do with a maintenance term and not a child support term. The court was well within its rights to modify child support. There's no disagreement there whatsoever. And when the court deferred the petitioner's argument in the motion for reconsideration, the only case I was really relied on was by the appellee was MF versus LM, 780 P. Second 69, 1989 Colorado appellate case. However, this case is completely based on Title 19, and specifically 19-4-119, which grants the court authority to modify or revoke any orders pursuant to 19-6-104. But again, this issue wasn't modifying child support. It was allowing for the calculation and the credits to be utilized in the calculation for the maintenance. And appellant was entitled to 54 months of that credit on the child support worksheet, and that's what was specifically ordered by the court.
Mr. Block, on the other hand, in her brief, the petitioner relies on the MGCG case, which wasn't the Title 19 case. It was under the Uniform Dissolution of Marriage Act.
Understood. And I think that was I'm saying at the time of the order, that was the case that was relied
right.
on. And then subsequently, that was relied on. But this again is talk about lump sum, that case talked about lump sum child support and how that could always be modified, because you can't, as I said in the beginning, you can't contract your right away to pay child support. The court has overwhelming jurisdiction to modify that if it's not consistent with, you know, with the law and the in 1410, 115, and 124 at the time. So that case had to do with a lump sum child support, and they said parties cannot contract their rights away for child support. In this case, we have a lump sum spousal maintenance, which can be contracted away, where it can, and there was an express term where it was contractual and non-modifiable. So the court did not have any jurisdiction but to allow for that child support credit of $2,157 to be included in the child support worksheet for the next 54 months. So one has to do with maintenance, one has to do with child support. But we felt the court was well within its rights to modify the child support using those maintenance calculations in the child support worksheet. And that's specifically what the parties agreed. And at the trial, no one really argued that order from the memorandum of understanding was not applicable to the court. So that was never a disagreement at the trial court level. So any other questions? That's all I have for right now.
Okay, you have a little less than 6.5 minutes, Mr. Block.
May it please the court, Justice Taubman, I'm Kathy Shirotis, attorney registration 23128 on behalf of appellee Lisa Baumgarten. I think in this case, there's a fundamental misunderstanding about the difference between child support and maintenance. The party's memorandum of understanding agreed that in lieu of Mr. Baumgarten continuing to pay spousal maintenance to Lisa Baumgarten, that he would instead make a lump sum payment. That payment was in the nature of a property division pursuant to Colorado law, and therefore at that point there was no more maintenance. The issue of maintenance is gone. The court, as the parties agreed, is divested of any jurisdiction to address the maintenance issue. There is no maintenance.
But Ms. Shirotis, wasn't part of the compromise with regard to the lump sum payment of maintenance or lump sum payment of $215,000 in lieu of maintenance that for 54 months that a certain amount would be credited with regard to child support?
It certainly was. It was essentially an agreement to impute some additional income to the petitioner and an agreement that the respondent's income would be decreased by a certain amount for that period of time. That was an agreement regarding what the party's income was, and it wasn't an agreement regarding maintenance. And I would say in response to Judge Miller's question regarding the 2157 number, that was a negotiated number. That didn't come off of a child support number anywhere. The 2157 was a negotiated number. I would also say with respect to the lump sum number that it wasn't only about maintenance, but it also included an additional property division piece, the sale of a property in Bond, Colorado, and reflecting part of petitioner's share from that potential sale. What we learned shortly after this memorandum of understanding was entered into is that the respondent had not fully disclosed his financial circumstances pursuant to his obligations under 16.2, where he has a duty of candor to his ex-spouse to provide full and complete disclosure. So therefore, subsequently, we filed a motion to modify the child support amount, which we can do pursuant to court, pursuant to statute 1410.115, and 122 if there is a substantial and continuing change of circumstance. In this case, we didn't know about it ahead of time, but it was something that was different and it hadn't been disclosed. So we filed the motion to modify it and unfortunately wasn't heard for over a year, which certainly made the change of circumstances different as of the time the court heard the case versus currently. Versus the time the motion was filed. But the basis for filing was that there had been a property transaction in which the respondent received a significant capital gain that we believed would have been includable in income for purposes of child support. We are not appealing that issue.
Mr. Rodas, it seems like we're talking about apples and oranges here, because Mr. Block just told us that he thought that, consistent with the memorandum of understanding, that the petitioner could move for a modification of child support, but that his contention is that the trial court failed to give effect to paragraph 3 of the memorandum of understanding. And you're telling us a different argument.
Well, I agree. I think that Mr. Block is confusing the concept of maintenance, which doesn't exist anymore, with the concept of income for purposes of child support.
Counsel, paragraph 3, I mean, I'm having trouble understanding. If we're looking at paragraph 3, it says, for purposes of child support only, then it goes on to say, the worksheet should reflect a 2157 month payment by respondent for the next 54 months. And then it says the new child support obligation will be $1,622.25 per month. So it clearly contemplates that this... It looks to me, and maybe I'm not understanding it, but it clearly contemplates that there will be this 2157 month credit on the worksheet.
It certainly did contemplate that. It wasn't an actual payment. It was an imputation of income for purposes of negotiating an agreement, so we didn't have to do an appeal, which was another reason for the stipulation. But fundamentally, the court always retains jurisdiction to modify child support, and I think the MCGG case is clearly on point with respect to the party's ability to negotiate away the support that's for the benefit of the children. And that's what we're talking about here. What is for the benefit of the children? It turns out that petitioner didn't have full and complete information from respondent at the time that she entered into this agreement. She didn't know some relevant facts that would have affected her ability to enter into this agreement. So when she discovered that, she filed a motion to modify.
And therefore, you're saying the court held this provision to be void because of the failure to make disclosure?
I think the court found what the party's actual income was for purposes of child support and determined that there was no maintenance being paid, and as a result did not impute additional income to my client for purposes of the child support statute.
How could that be squared with paragraph 3 of the MOU and the
Because again, I think the court always retains jurisdiction to determine what the accurate and true income of the parties is. And the court always retains the jurisdiction to be able to modify child support if that's in the best interest of the children and there's substantial and continuing change in circumstances.
Well, in the MGCG case, the division said that if it were appropriate, the court could have applied the child support guidelines, and then if the result were improper or unfair, it could have deviated from the guidelines.
Right. I think the court always retains the jurisdiction to deviate from the guidelines if it determines that that deviation is appropriate and the court makes the appropriate findings. I think in this particular case, had the court imputed this additional income to my client for purposes of child support, the court then would have had to make those findings because it's not based upon what the actual income is of the parties pursuant to the child support worksheet or statute.
But couldn't the district court have done that shouldn't the district court have done that?
I think the court had the discretion to do that. I think it's in the court's discretion to determine what the appropriate income is of the parties and make a determination for purposes of child support how the guidelines should read. I think the court in this case did impute income to my client. The court imputed $2,500 a month of income to my client that the court didn't have to do, but she was unemployed at the time. So what the court would have done is impute $2,500 to her and then impute an additional $2,157 to her to make her income $4,000-something a month, which is not true or accurate. In addition, you know, the court could have said, so she got this lump sum payment of $215,000. Let's determine what the actual income is that she would be receiving from that lump sum payment and then impute that additional amount of income to her. That issue wasn't raised at the lower court by respondents, so I don't think the court addressed it, but the court could have at that time.
Let me step back a minute, Ms. Shiroz, and ask you a question. You told us several minutes ago that Mr. Baumgarten had not properly disclosed his financial circumstances. If that were the case, wouldn't the appropriate remedy have been to try and set aside the memorandum of understanding?
Your Honor, I actually think we had a number of choices available to us, and strategically we made a decision to go this route. It may, in retrospect, not have been the right decision, but I think we certainly could have made a motion to set aside this memorandum of understanding. We chose to file the motion to modify the child support in part because of case law regarding capital gains and in-marriage of the Upson, which indicated to us that capital gains can be includable in income for purposes of child support, but it's only includable in the year in which the gain was made. And so we discovered the gain, I believe, in end of October, early November 2009. We were getting to the end of the year, so we filed the motion before the end of 2009 so we could potentially have the benefit of that case law. We also could have filed a motion under 16.2, which we may still consider doing but haven't done so, to set aside the property division as a result of the failure to disclose and the lack of candor on the part of the respondent. I think we had a number of options available to us, and I don't think that they were all mutually exclusive.
Is it your understanding that the trial court essentially did set aside the MOU?
I don't think the court said that. I don't think the court set aside the MOU, because I think the court specifically found, pursuant to the parties' agreement in the MOU, there is no maintenance. And now I am divested of jurisdiction from addressing that issue.
In the absence of the court setting aside the MOU, what are we supposed to do with that? Isn't it still in effect? And isn't the court's order authorizing the MOU or making it an order of the court? Aren't we stuck with that?
Well, I think with respect to the maintenance piece, yes. And I think the court was stuck with that, yes. But I think with respect to the issue regarding income for purposes of child support, the court always retains jurisdiction to modify child support. And so the court always can go back and look at the agreement of the parties and determine if there's has been any continuing change in circumstances that should justify a modification of the child support.
So I understand your position, but here's the problem that I'm having. Mm-hmm. According to this MOU, a certain amount is supposed to be deducted from the wife's side of the ledger, and that didn't happen. So why aren't, I understand that the court can modify the child support at any time. But isn't that piece of it, the fact that the trial court didn't take that off her side of the ledger, isn't that a problem?
I think that it's not a problem. I think that the court did what it needed to do in terms of looking at what its obligations were for purposes of determining an appropriate child support figure in the best interest of the children and pursuant to the statute. The court, I don't believe, specifically addressed that additional $21.57 a month here or there. I think what the court said is she's not receiving any additional income. There is no maintenance. I don't have the authority to impute additional maintenance to her because that's been divested from me. And therefore, I'm finding that her income, I'm imputing the $2,500 a month to her in income, but I'm not imputing additional incomes to her. I'm not going to deduct anything from his income. And therefore, this is the new child support figure.
So, in other words, he changed his ruling on September 21, which said the worksheet will reflect a 21.57 month payment by a respondent to petitioner to be included in petitioner's income and deducted from respondent's income for a period of 54 months. The order he issued in January changed that order, right?
He did. He said that any prior order that was inconsistent with this in his order regarding the reconsideration, he said any prior inconsistent orders shall be read to be consistent with the January order.
It seemed to be anything in the written order. Was there anything he said orally that explained why he did that?
The only thing I recollect specifically about his oral order was that he felt that he did not have the authority, that there was no maintenance. There is no maintenance. That issue is resolved. It's off the table. And therefore, I'm looking at the actual incomes for purposes of child support. Other than that, I don't recall that he addressed that issue specifically. I have nothing further.
Thank you, Ms. Shirotas.
Just a few points. What the court essentially did was invalidate or a maintenance order that was no longer modifiable by the court based on the expressed order that was signed back in September of 2010. There was always full disclosure. The court never found that there was a lack of disclosure by the appellant at any point in time during the hearing or in any orders whatsoever. What the court did was it used the factors enumerated in 1410.115 in figuring out what the child support should be. He failed to provide for the spousal maintenance credit, 2157. If the court had done that, based on his calculations using the other figures he used in his calculation, child support would have been ordered at $1,683. And that's attached as Exhibit 7 in our opening brief. The prior order was $1,622. So if you look at those two numbers, there was no 10% change overall for there to be a substantial continuing change of circumstances. So the order would have had to stay at the previous order of $1,622. Appellee did receive maintenance. She received a lump sum payment of $215,000. They agreed in lieu of that to calculate that in the guidelines, and the court failed to do that. And on any standard of review, this needs to be overturned and give appellant the benefit of his bargain based on the court order.
As a question, if at the time of permanent orders, the $215,000 had been included in the property division, would it have come out the same as it did in paragraph 3 of the MOU, that is the support payment?
I'm not sure about the question, so I'm not exactly sure how to answer that.
The MOU says the $215,000 is to be treated as a division of property, right?
That's correct.
Well, if that had happened in the first instance at the time of permanent orders, would there not have been any maintenance payment then at that point in time because of that property division?
Yeah, if it was simply a property division, there would be no credit for maintenance, but this was a hybrid, and that's how the memorandum of understanding was written. That was the agreement of the parties. And there was some property division. Like I said, there was other issues than what was right before the appeal appellate court at the time that was agreed on. And so that was part of the agreement, but it was clear that part of that was maintenance. And instead of paying $4,500 a month to, you know, in the future, he paid a lump sum. So that was the agreement of the parties. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Block. Thank you, both Mr. Block and Mr. Rodas. We appreciate your arguments this morning in this case. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.